Chapter 14, Sidelights of Will Rogers. The little human interest stories told about Will Rogers are almost countless. Everyone that knew him had dozens that they would relate. All of them displayed some one of the many facets that went to make the humorist the great man that he was. Rogers was Bill to brother members at the Friars Club. Friar Joe Lowry tells the following about him. Bill and I were discussing after-dinner speaking, of which he was one of the best. I asked him when and where his first speech was ever made. At the YMCA, when I was a kid, said Bill. I complained about the shower baths. I strolled into the library at the Friars Club one day and caught Bill reading a book. What are you reading, Bill? I asked. I was just reading the Constitution of the United States, and I was surprised to find out how many rights the people really have, answered Bill. Bill and Frank Hawk, while making their tour through Arkansas giving concerts and raising money for the drought victims, were in an automobile making a trip from the flying field to the local convention hall where they were to appear. The roads were bad and the car got stuck. A native passed by and they asked him if he would help them out. The native, with a surly look, said no and drove on. Rogers turned to Hawks and said, "If that is the milk of human kindness, I will take mine from a cow." The Prince of Wales, who was a great personal friend of Will Rogers, was making a trip to Africa on a goodwill and hunting expedition. Someone asked Rogers whether it was true that the prince was really going. "Sure," said Bill. "The prince is going to shoot wild animals as fast as they come out of their cages." Prosperity returns. Rogers predicted the return of prosperity on October 29, 1932, when arriving in New York. He said, "Flew here today from Florida. Was going to stop in Washington, but the newspaper boys told me there wasn't a soul there. Ain't Mr. Hoover there? No, he has gone to save Indiana. Well, I know my old Injun friend Charlie Curtis is here. No, he is saving Kansas. Well, then, I'll just drop up and see some of the boys in the cabinet. Why, there is none of the cabinet. That's been gone since early in the spring. Well, who's running the country? Why, nobody. That's why things are kind of picking up." Soak the rich. Another of his jibes in 1932 at the spending attitude of our legislators is reflected in a dispatch that purported to be the diary of a U.S. senator trying to find $2 billion that they have already spent but didn't have. It read, "Monday, soak the rich. Tuesday, begin hearing from the rich. Tuesday afternoon, decide to give the rich a chance to get richer. Wednesday, tax Wall Street stock sales. Thursday, get word from Wall Street. Lay off us or you will get no campaign contributions. Thursday afternoon, decide we are wrong about Wall Street. Friday, soak the little fellow. Saturday morning, find out there is no little fellow. He has been soaked until he is drowned. Sunday, meditate. Next week, same procedure, only more talk and less results." A horse laughed. A corner of New York that was one of Will's favorites was East 24th Street near Lexington Avenue. A horse market was held there in those days, and the neighborhood was studded with saddlers and blacksmith shops. One day, an apparently broken-down nag was put up at auction. Nobody wanted the animal. Will strolled in just as the auctioneer was about to order the horse taken away. $20, the comedian sang out. "Sold," cried the delighted auctioneer. The teeming contractors and horse dealers grinned slyly, winked at each other, as the awkward-looking Westerner bought the animal, which none of them would have taken as a gift. Will sent the horse to Oklahoma to be put out to pasture. In a year, the animal had rounded into flesh and strength. A breeder of Hackney's offered him $2,000 for it. "Nope, he ain't for sale," Roger said. "I'm keeping him as a souvenir of New York, the big town where the wise guys come from." The horse lived to round out his days on the lush acres of the Rogers Ranch, and in his time beget many a son and daughter that brought fancy figures. It was one of Will's few real-life experiences in a David Harum role, a character he was to play on screen years later. One on McAdoo. It was at Ziegfeld's informal entertainments that Will, for the first time, began to develop a reputation for spontaneous wit. The cabaret style of entertainment drew the same patrons to the midnight frolic night after night, and there was necessity for variety in his jokes. But that did not faze Will. Accordingly, he kept up with current events and changed his gags daily to fit the trend in the newspaper. Eventually, habitual patrons would interrupt to ask him to comment on specific subjects. Sometimes they engaged in repertoire from the floor, and Will had to be on his toes constantly. He was equal to it. Gradually, his mind quickened into the infallible mechanism which never failed him, on or off, for an epigram or a rejoinder. Even in the Follies, he would indulge in his impromptu fun, and some nights he spotted personalities in the audience and singled them out for his jokes. He once saw William McAdoo from the stage and requested the gentleman from California to leave his seat and come up behind the footlights. McAdoo hesitated, but Will insisted, and finally, blushing profusely, he climbed up beside the comedian and stood blinking in the spotlight. "Really," stammered McAdoo, "I thought I was through with politics." "You are," drawled Rogers, and the audience roared. "Don't say ain't." A friend met him after a long absence and invited him to dinner. "No thanks," Will answered. "I've already ate." His friend corrected, "You shouldn't say it. You should say have eaten." Rogers grinned and drawled, "Well, I know a lot of fellers who say have eaten who ain't et." Word of advice. Congressman William Connery, Democrat from Massachusetts, told of the time when he and Rogers appeared on the same vaudeville stage at Rochester, New York in 1910. "Rogers had a favorite story to encourage other actors," said Connery. "It went like this. When I first got a vaudeville job, I had four horses. I dropped one horse and got more money. Then I dropped another horse and I got a raise. Finally, I dropped all the horses and I'm getting more money now than I ever did." Beverly Hills Pioneers. Reminiscing with neighbors, Will Rogers said, "We lived out here in the early days with nothing but bean fields around us. When ground is so poor that nothing will grow, beans will flourish, and many travelers used to come out to watch the beans grow. We lived next to a vacant lot, and a family began moving in. We were putting up a wired fence, and learning that the new neighbor was a lawyer, we put two barbed wires on top of the fence. I don't like to say it's the best, but Beverly Hills is one of the best-known towns in the world. It is one of the early California settlements, settled about 1914. It was nothing in those days but a bean field, and not good navy beans, but just butter beans. Hollywood was breaking records both in production and scandal, and many motion picture people moved out here because they didn't want their neighbors to see who they were entertaining. Beverly Hills was settled by renegade actors from Hollywood. About 1919 was the first real estate slump, and the restrictions were removed, and that is when I came in. The town was gone along wonderful. You know, we had splendid times in the old days. The town was just going along fine when somebody wanted to incorporate it and have bonds and a city council. And then they started to degenerate, and when they got the city council, they started loans that put second mortgages on most homes. We got along great and have a wonderful police force and a jail. Our chief, you know, won't arrest any of the citizens. We had a little bad luck when the police caught John Gilbert and put him in jail. Since then, nobody will go to it. In the early days, we had no churches. Now we have plenty of churches, but no congregations. Then we all put in $500 to build a drugstore and a grocery store. If you think this town has always been well-to-do, try to find out what became of that $500. The town has grown until it is known all over the country. I think it is one of the best little towns in the United States, but I hope it won't get too good. Will Rogers shrewdly estimated that persons who pushed forward out of every crowd and clamored to meet him when he observed, "Feller comes up and says, 'I see all your pictures.' I ask him, 'Which ones?' And he can't name one. Woman brings up a little 5-year-old girl and says, 'Tilly wants to meet you.' And she reads all your articles in the papers and enjoys them. Tilly says, 'Who is he, Ma?'" Will Rogers bred some fine polo ponies, but when wealthy players sought to buy any of them, he referred them to the cowboys who worked around the movie lots. He did that, it was said, so the boys, some of whom he trooped with in the Wild West days, could run up the prices and make something on the sale. At a reception given by the National Press Club in Washington, Rogers was named Congressman at Large and presented with a scroll attesting to his high and hitherto unheard of office. His duties were, quote, to roam the country, pry into the state of the union, check upon prohibition enforcement. His tenure of office was to continue during good behavior, and the job was carried a suspended salary of $1 a year. The winner. For many years, Will Rogers always could be counted upon to dig down in his pocket and provide extra prize money for the contestants at the annual rodeo in Madison Square Garden. Having taken part in many similar contests, he knew how the boys needed the money. One year, however, he announced that he had his own idea for a contest and that he alone would be the judge. He asked that Maverick, a wild-eyed stallion, be let out. He then proceeded to give the animal a rhinestone-studded feed bag as the champion wild horse of the show. You fellers, he told the riders, have been getting paid for the animal's work for years. It's about time one of the nags got a break. At the same time, however, he put up his usual amount for the extra prizes. Better times. Shortly before the flight to the Arctic, someone called attention to the fact that Rogers' fan mail was greatly increased over the preceding year. Signs of better times, said Will. More people have money to throw away on postage stamps. Suggests cup for Lipton. Sir Thomas Lipton, the gallant Irish sportsman who tried for so many years unsuccessfully to bring the America's Cup back to England, found only sympathy from Rogers. After the last of Lipton's Shamrocks was defeated, Rogers suggested that everybody send a dollar to Mayor Walker at New York to buy Lipton a bigger cup than the one he would have received if he had won. Rogers said the cup should carry the inscription to possibly the world's worst yacht builder, but absolutely the world's most cheerful loser. You have been a benefit to mankind, Sir Thomas. The suggestion was carried out by Mayor Walker. Foreign affairs. Commenting on various foreign situations at different times, Rogers said, I just wanted to see whether Trotsky ate, drank, slept, and laughed like a human, or whether his whole life was taken up for the betterment of mankind. On the Chino-Japanese War, Rogers humorously drew the conclusion, nobody knows what they are fighting about. It's almost like a European war in that respect. His observations of English customs and American tourists were amusing. England has more money invested in dress suits and dinner jackets than America has plows and farming utensils. It is open season now in Europe for grouse and Americans. They shoot the grouse to put them out of their misery. Doctor of applesauce. The Oklahoma City University once considered offering Will Rogers an honorary degree of Doctor of Letters, one of the highest degrees. Will gleefully replied, what are you trying to do? Make a joke out of college degrees? They are in bad enough repute as it is, without handing them around to comedians. The whole honorary degree thing is hooey. I saw some college giving Mellon one, and he is a billion bucks short. I got too much respect for people that work and earn them to see them handed around to every notorious character. And modest, great Will concluded, my limit is a plain A.D., Doctor of Applesauce, from Oogalash, Oklahoma Kindergarten. First political speech. In 1922, Rogers was asked by Kermit Roosevelt to make a congressional election speech for Ogden Mills, a Republican. Will, a lifelong Democrat, delivered some of the best quips, but Mills never even smiled. Rogers said, in part, I have spoken in all kinds of joints, from one of Mrs. Vanderbilt's parties to Sing Sing and O.C. Sing, but this is my first political speech, and I hope it flops. I don't want it to go over and then have to go into politics because, up to now, I've always tried to live honest. A great many think I was sent here by Mr. Mills' opponent. This is not the case. I don't know him, but he must be a scoundrel. From what I have read of politics, every opponent is. He must also be a tool of the interests. I believe the least you can do is to say that in a political speech. Mr. Mills is quite a novelty. He is one of the few men that didn't go into politics from necessity. He was wealthy when he started. He is the only congressman we can send to Congress who can go into a Fifth Avenue home without delivering something. Wisecracks. In his film, Life Begins at 40, Rogers declared, "Hen eggs is more popular than duck eggs because a hen cackles to advertise her product. If them quintuplets, the Dionnes, was born in this country, two of them would have to have been plowed under. These days and times, nobody's got a right to be old folks." A joke on Rogers. In the movie picture, Life Begins at 40, Will Rogers found himself confronted with a situation about which he could not think of one of his ready answers. The situation of the story was a newspaper office conducted by Rogers, and the proofreader took him to task for misspelling so many words. Rogers accused the scenarist, Lamar Trotty, of framing him. Help wanted. One day in the studio restaurant, Rogers overheard Alice Faye describe a friend as the silliest man she ever met because he laughed at everything. "Better give me his name," interrupted Rogers. "He'd be a good man for me to try my jokes out on." Gives Rockefeller a dime. Rogers turned the tables on John D. Rockefeller at Ormond Beach, Florida in 1927 while playing a round of golf with the aged oil multimillionaire. Rockefeller, for many years, had made a practice of passing out shiny new dimes as presents on his birthday. Rogers started in to make Rockefeller smile. "Is it true, Mr. Rockefeller," asked Rogers, "that every time you lose a golf match, the price of gasoline goes up a cent?" Rockefeller was thoroughly amused at that one, but a few minutes later, Rogers made him laugh when he solemnly presented the oil magnate with a dime after the latter had made an exceptionally good shot. Give him bad advice. Charles Lathrop Pack, president of the American Tree Association, told how Rogers gave him advice in handling an educational campaign in tree planting. "Will Rogers told me," said Pack, "that I was on the wrong track in trying to educate people to the value of putting idle land to work growing trees. Pack," he said, "you go down to Washington and get Congress to pass a law prohibiting tree planting, and you'll have everybody doing it in a week." Corn Doctor Rogers. When Will Rogers finished the filming of Irvin Cobb's masterpiece, Judge Priest, the comedian was presented with a traveling kit. He looked at it and observed, "This thing looks to me like a corn doctor's layout. I've always wanted to be a corn doctor, and now that I'm traveling over to Russia and Poland, I wish some of the movie producers here would give me letters to their relatives and friends back there so as I can do some business with them. Just give me a list of your families, and I'll call on them and tell them how you're doing, and then I'll sell them corn plasters." Meets Mussolini. When he met Mussolini, Will Rogers grinned. "Interview?" asked Mussolini. "No interview," declared Mr. Rogers. "Hooray, bravo, no interview," shouted Mussolini, and he sat down with the cowboy comedian and laughed at his jokes. Puncturing a balloon. Will Rogers was against the inflationary measures that were proposed by New Deal politicians under President Franklin Roosevelt, and once declared, "We will never get anywhere with our finances till we pass a law saying that every time we appropriate something, we got to pass another bill along with it stating where the money is coming from." A helping hand. When the Friars Club of New York, of which he was one of the leading members, lost their famous clubhouse, the Monastery, on West 48th Street, a movement was set on foot to get a donation of $500 from each of the wealthier members of the club. He wrote, "It is worth $500 to see my brother members playing pinochle on the street. On second thought, it is worth $500 to get them off the street." He enclosed a check for $1,000. In Society Column, the Society Column of the newspaper in Rogers, Arkansas, carried the following social note in November 26, 1908, about Rogers' marriage. Miss Betty Blake and Will Rogers of Claremore, Oklahoma, were married this afternoon at 1 o'clock by the Reverend J.G. Bailey at the home of the bride's mother, Mrs. A.J. Blake, in East Walnut Street. Advice on Foreign Policy. The government's practice in 1932 of writing notes to Japan warning them what not to do caused Rogers to advise that we had better quit or Japan will have all of China. Every time they get a note, they take another town that they hadn't thought of until our note gave them the idea, he added. The way we got into the last war was through notes. We send so many, nations can't tell which one we mean. Our wars ought to be labeled entered on account of too much penmanship. Calculating Cal. Rogers delighted in poking fun at the president, whoever he was. He was Rogers' friend, and even mimicked the late Calvin Coolidge on a radio program. Cairo's a great place, he wisecracked. I was the only tourist there who ever went out to see the Sphinx. Well, I've seen Cal Coolidge. Easy education. They say children in kindergarten must play in order to get them to learn. What do you mean, children? Crossword puzzles learned grown folks more words than school teachers. And what arithmetic the women folks know, they got at a bridge table. Our splendid English comes from attending the movies. My geography comes from an airplane window. Yes, sir, there is 120 million in the American kindergarten. Foul ball. Rogers and Fred Stone appeared at a civic banquet put on in Los Angeles to inspire the revival of interest in baseball. For an hour, they held a great crowd of diners spellbound. Rogers imitated Stone's dances, and Stone did Rogers' rope stuff. At the end of the act, Rogers returned to his seat to find it occupied by a man who was urging the Toastmaster to let him make a speech. He had dined not wisely, but too well, and was inclined to argue when Rogers suggested that he was in the wrong seat. Rogers waved to the floor of the banquet hall and said with his infectious grin, "I'm playing this base. You're out in center field." Bullseye. I wonder if this Abyssinian king could sue and get his dues back that he has paid into the League of Nations for protection. I bet you that history doesn't record any two nations ever having war with each other unless they had a conference first. There ain't but one word wrong with every one of us in the world, and that's selfishness. I bet any Sunday could be made as popular at church as Easter if you made them into fashion shows, too. One of his favorite sayings was, "It's a great country, but you can't live in it for nothing." After Queen Marie had concluded her tour of the United States, he ruminated that there is a fortune to be made for the person that can make something out of slightly used Romanian flags. Commenting upon the investigation of Mayor Walker of New York, he said that no man was ever so investigated on one hand and dined on the other. He keeps three decorations ahead of the investigating committee. France gave Jimmy Walker the Legion of Honor because he didn't bring 19 other mayors with him. Congressional investigators are for the benefit of photographers. Dandruff. Irvin S. Cobb, the famous author, once cracked a joke at Rogers' expense, but from then on he feared the revenge that might follow and always asked to be called upon to speak at dinners after Will had delivered his speech. The occasion was at a Friars Club dinner where Will Hayes, the movie czar, had paid tribute to Rogers by saying, "They call New York a cold, heartless giant, but it has true appreciation of true and real worth." When Will first blew in an Oklahoma cowboy with a rope in his hand and a wad of chewing gum in his mouth, it didn't take New York long to find there was something under the old black cowboy slouch besides hair. Cobb couldn't resist the opportunity. He jumped up and said, "I'm deeply touched by what Mr. Hayes just said, because it's high time in this country that someone is speaking a kind word about dandruff." Hometown stuff. Will was once urged to go back to Oklahoma City and give a show in an armory which seated 10,000 persons. "But I'm not going," said Rogers. "Not back there where they all know me. Why, they'd say, 'Will's just talking the way he used to talk on the street corner around here. Old Cap Stallings can talk more than that. This is no show.'" TR, ideal audience. Theodore Roosevelt was Rogers' notion of the ideal audience. "I never got him into the theater, but I gave him a couple of private shows, and he liked them and laughed. And when I got all done, he said, 'That's fine, but go ahead now and do all the jokes you tell about me.'" Introducing Lady Astor. One night, Lady Astor was in the audience at the Follies, and Rogers asked her if she would stand up. She did so graciously. "When I played in London," Rogers said, "I used to visit Lady Astor at the House of Parliament. When she came to see me, when I was playing over there, I tried to get her to stand up and take a bow, and she always refused. Yet, every time I went to see her in the House of Parliament, they could never get her to sit down." On First Nighters, Will Rogers was convinced that the avenged First Night audience on Broadway didn't keep abreast of current events, as he tried out many of his gags on them only to have them fall flat. "They know about boots and shoes and automobiles," Rogers once remarked, "but they don't read the newspapers. Next season, I won't appear on the first night. I'll show the second night." But a First Night of the Follies without Rogers wouldn't have been much of a success. From the Follies. On the opening night of the Follies in 1918, Will Rogers cleverly summed up the new show in the following way. "It's a great thing to see the Follies on its first night, because by the time you get back to your homes in the Bronx, a lot of the show will be in Kane's theatrical storehouse, along with a bunch of my jokes. A first night of the Follies is a great function. Everyone brings his new wife to see his old one act. You see, we had quite a lot of trouble keeping our girls together on tour. Every town we went to, some of them would marry a millionaire, but in a few weeks they would be divorced and catch up with the show again. Women are like elephants. I like to look at them, but I'd hate to own one." Wartime stuff. The World War furnished Rogers with a lot of his stage material. "The United States is going to be much more severe with the German spies that are captured in the future. We are going to put their names in the papers. We're getting a lot of actors in the Army. I heard the other day that George Cohen was going to join the Nasal Brigade. I read in the paper that President Wilson made another speech. I suppose congressmen will come along now and misunderstand him. It must be awful hard for a smart man like the president to make a speech in such a way that a bonehead congressman and a highbrow mail carrier will both get what he means." A humorous catechism. Will Rogers once derived considerable fun from writing out his own questions and answers on the subject of humor. Some of them read, "What's the best way to start being a humorist? Recovery from the mule kick is one way that's used a lot. Being dropped head downward on a pavement in youth has been responsible for a lot. But a discharge from an asylum for mental cases is almost surefire. Is the field of humor crowded? Only when Congress is in session. What talent is necessary? Must one be born with a funny bone in the head? It's not talent, it's an affliction. If a funny bone is necessary, I would say that in the head is the best place to have it. That's the least used of the humorous equipment." His favorite dish. The Gilded Lobster Palaces of the Broadway Playboys had no charm for Rogers when he was starring in the Ziegfeld Follies. He preferred a little hole-in-the-wall restaurant where they had, in his opinion, the best chili peppers and chili con carne in New York. It is at 7th Avenue and 47th Street, and he went there almost nightly, sitting on one of the white stools in the little corner to eat his chili. The place is called El Rancho and is owned by a Swede named Arvid Strom. The nationality of the proprietor always gave Will a laugh. He could not reconcile that fellow being the proprietor of a Mexican cafe that sold chili con carne. A Swede running a chili joint, he once said, that's a great gag. In those days, Rogers was getting $500 for personal appearances at banquets, and he told Strom, I can only make those speeches by eating chili before and after. Meeting with Medevenis. When Rogers first met the Medevenis brothers, Princes David and Serge, whose matrimonial experiences were varied, he wisecracked, well, boys, I'm happy to meet you, but don't ask me to marry you. His very first movie. Will Rogers' first experience before the motion picture camera actually took place 6 years before he went on the movie lots. In 1912, a deer drive was organized at Shelter Island after the animals had caused havoc in gardens there. One of those taking part in the drive was Will. He was knocked down by a buck and later found a small fawn. A newsreel camera asked Rogers to pose with the young animal in his arms. Recommendation. What the Red Cross thought of Will Rogers was shown in a telegram made public after the humorous death. It was sent to him in 1933 by John Barton Payne, the head of the organization. It read, when I pass from the Red Cross and knock at St. Peter's Gate, he will ask, who comes here? I will answer, John Barton Payne, chairman of the American Red Cross. He will ask, by what right do you expect to enter? I will answer, I knew Will Rogers. He will say, that is sufficient. Come right in. Payne died in January 1935. Winning a bet from Lindbergh. On the opening of Three Cheers in New York, Will Rogers won a wager from Colonel Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh knew that Rogers took great delight in calling on celebrities to stand up and be introduced to the house. The famous flyer asked Rogers not to introduce him, and in joking about it, Lindbergh bet the comedian he would not be able to resist the temptation. It was the hardest bet I ever won in my life, Rogers declared. Political advice. The worst thing Alfred E. Smith ever did in his campaign for president, in the opinion of Will Rogers, was to wear a brown derby. It would have been better, he told a group at the Friars Club, if Al had worn overalls and a hay hat. That derby made him look like a city slicker. Only senators. One day, Rogers was engaged in one of his favorite pastimes, gabbing, with a couple of stagehands in the New Amsterdam Theater. The doorman came up and said, Mr. Rogers, there are a couple of senators waiting at the door for you. Oh, let them wait a minute, Rogers replied. They're only senators. A graceful gesture. Will Rogers, by a simple act of thoughtfulness, saved the annual dinner of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in 1934 from being turned into an anticlimax. Charles Laughton and Katharine Hepburn, who won the awards for 1933, were not able to present. Rogers called the four runner-ups, Paul Mooney, Leslie Howard, Mae Robson, and Diana Wynward, to the speaker's platform. After the 800 Hollywood notables present had applauded, Wills presented each of the four with a rose from a bouquet in front of him. A few statistics. How many times have I whirled a rope? Rogers asked by way of answering a question. Well, I roughly calculate that if the lariat was long enough and all the loops I've coaxed out of it could be made into one, it would pretty near circle this big globe of ours. The number of tons of chewing gum I've masticated while spinning monologues comes under the head of manufacturing statistics. When jokes failed. Despite the fact that Rogers tried out his jokes on his family and others before presenting them on the stage, it sometimes happened that the audience would fail to find them mirth-provoking. For the average monologuist, that was a serious situation, but Rogers knew how to handle it. When I tell a couple of jokes and there is only a ripple of laughter, he said, I stall with the talk and get into heavy action with the rope. Then I give the audience the damnedest 2 minutes of rope swinging you ever saw. Rogers and his gum. The eternal wad of gum that Rogers chewed upon the stage was only a part of the act. But one night on the New Amsterdam roof, he accidentally swallowed it in the midst of his monologue. He gulped and then excused himself for a moment. He ran to his dressing room and procured another package of gum. "I feel as conspicuous without my gum," he explained to the audience, "as a chorus girl in ankle-length skirts, straight from the shoulders." One day when his audience was at a lecture and was made up largely of women, Will Rogers looked at them with a twinkle in his eye and declared, "You women just prowl from one meeting to another. Each one of you ought to be home cooking lunch instead of being here. Americans will join anything in town but their families. Why, two Americans can't meet on the street without one banging a gavel and calling the other to order." Collecting the pay. In the early days with Zach Mulhall's Wild West, Rogers and Tom Mix were close friends, and there were times when the circus owner had difficulty meeting the payroll. On such occasions, Rogers once related, Mulhall would go to the hotel bar and buy drinks for anyone in the place as a means of calling attention to a show. "Tom and I were not invited to come over for a drink," said Rogers with his inimitable drawl. "We were only working for Colonel Mulhall. But we went there just the same, and we framed up a way to get something out of the old showman. Zach would shout out, asking everybody to have a drink with him, and Tom and I watched the actions of the old man. We knew that sooner or later he would have to pay for the drinks, and when he pulled out a roll and peeled off a big bill, we'd edge up on each side of him without giving him a chance to suspect what was going on. We had resolved that we would get some money somehow that night, and it was with relief that we saw Zach hand a $20 bill to the bartender. We waited for our chance, and the second the bartender put the change on the bar, our hand shot out and grabbed all of it, to Zach's relief and surprise." Goat roping leads to polo. How Will Rogers became a polo enthusiast was revealed by J.A. Wigmore, Cleveland millionaire and polo player, who taught the game to the humorist. In 1920 in Hollywood, two cowboys became involved in an argument over which could rope and tie a goat in the shortest time, said Wigmore. The result was a contest, and when the day for the contest arrived, the side bet exceeded $1,000. The affair was staged in Beverly Hills, and Rogers, who threw a mean rope and was no slouch as a rider, challenged the winner. A few days later, Rogers telephoned me and asked permission to borrow a pair of cutting horses I had brought to Pasadena from my ranch in New Mexico. I lent them to him, and Rogers easily won the goat roping championship. The next day, he telephoned me and said, "I have no idea what price you might set on those horses, so I'm sending you a signed check. You fill it in, and I just gotta have them." I told him if the boys in the ranch found out I had sold those ponies, they'd never let me back on the ranch, adding that the only way I could square matters would be to make them a present. Rogers was reluctant to accept them, but he did and agreed to on the condition imposed that he would come out to Midwick and learn to play stick and ball. He came, and soon he was crazy about the game. Not a candidate. In the days when Rogers was enjoying his great popularity as a citizen of California, a movement was started to have Will Rogers entered in the race for governor of the state, but the gubernatorial boom ended as quickly as it started when he declared, "I'm not a candidate for anything. I'd rather be a poor actor than a poor governor. After rawhiding these fellows for so many years, I'm satisfied to remain fancy-free, to go where I please, when I please." At a loss for words, Will Rogers' fame as a humorist was based upon the fact that he could be depended upon to say the unexpected right thing at the unexpected right moment. Owen Young once called him on the long-distance telephone and asked him to share a radio program with President Hoover in behalf of unemployment relief. 15 minutes later, talking with Young, a fellow actor found him sitting at the telephone staring into space. "What's the matter, Bill?" the actor asked. "Boy, I'm scared to death," he replied. "I've got to help Hoover make a speech." Getting away with it. A friend once asked Rogers how he managed to get by without getting into difficulty over his quips and jests about persons and things. I get by, he answered, because I ain't for anything. I ain't selling anything. I ain't got a remedy for anything. It's easy to kid a big man, but you've got to look out for the little fellows. A big man will take it a joke on himself, but you've got to be careful if his secretary is around. There are some awful silly people. I got the most ridiculous letter once from a girl, and she said I was a Bolshevik and anti-American and a menace to the country because I made light remarks about our president. If a fellow doesn't have a good time once in a while and get a good laugh out of the serious side of life, he doesn't half live. Random shots. We stood through one speech, Rogers said, of the London Naval Conference in 1930, sat through 8 and slept through 12, and in 3 solid hours of compliments, not a rowboat was sunk. You people, he told a crowd at Buenos Aires, export meat, wheat, and gigolos, and the United States puts a tariff on the wrong too. When Andrew Mellon was named ambassador to England, Rogers chirped, why, a man with as much money as Andy could be popular anywhere. The movie game is easier than it was. They used to have a terrible time getting actors to cry for the scene. Every actor cries now when he hears the salary he's going to get. A holding company is where you hand an accomplice the goods while a policeman searches you. They're as busy as usual passing appropriation bills like hot briskets at a country farmhouse. One thing about farmers' relief, it can't last long, for the farmers ain't got much more to be relieved of. Worry's father. After Will Rogers had begun to earn a little money as a vaudeville performer, his first thought was to show his father that he was on the road to success. He saved his money until he had $500 and then sent his father a draft for that amount. His father didn't need the money, and instead of being pleased, he became very suspicious of this queer business of his son's. The old gentleman, then a member of the Oklahoma Constitutional Convention, showed the draft to William H. Alfalfa Bill Murray, who afterwards became a colorful governor of that state. Do you think Willie made that money honestly? Murray, who related the story years later, assured the elder Rogers that the money was undoubtedly earned honestly. Of early vintage, one of Rogers' earliest quips from the stage was carried on down through the years as one of his best. He was twirling a rope in a vaudeville show when, during a lull, he remarked carelessly to the audience, "Swinging a rope's all right if your neck ain't in it." The audience, taken by surprise, roared at the quip. Rogers later admitted he was surprised at the response. Notes on Russia. They got a great idea over there in Russia. They divide everything up, but nobody had anything to divide in the first place. Russian men wear their shirts hanging outside their pants. Any nation that don't know enough to tuck in their shirt tail will never get anywhere. Grammar and I get along like a Russian in a bathtub. A century of progress. In a radio address, Rogers used the century of progress in Chicago as a springboard to hurl a few criticisms at programs or progress in general. That century of progress exhibition is misnamed. I can't figure whether we made any progress in the last 100 years or not. I think they ought to call it what the last 100 years has done to us. You take in 1833, we had only 36 senators, and the evil has grown now until we have 96. And did you know there wasn't such a thing as a stenographer in 1833? Every congressman could write then. And 100 years ago, we were on the gold standard, and 100 years ago, Europe didn't owe us anything. We were smart enough to owe them. I tell you, the older we get, the dumber we get. Then you lived until you died, and not until you were just run over. Governor wanted. Will Rogers once was asked to become one of the board of governors at the Friars Club, and he declined because the movies required him to spend most of his time in Hollywood. If it's a humorist you want, there are any number of them in the club, he said. If it's an actor you want, there's no end of good actors, and there are plenty of newspaper men. The only thing I can do that they can is spin a rope. If it's a governor you really want, there's Friar Al Smith. Will Rogers always had a very humble opinion of himself, despite the plaudits that were accorded him. regardless of the continuous stream of gold that poured into his pockets, and apparently unmindful of the assurances of his closest friends, he never made any pretensions about himself or the high place he held in the world. His own estimate of himself was, "Shucks, I was just an old cowhand that had a little luck. Why all this here fuss about me?" Chapter 15. Will Rogers, the Man. There was only one Will Rogers. His generation never produced a man with such a wide variety of outstanding talents. His genius was unique, and it led him on to where he was sought by princes and presidents. But he always remained the plain, unassuming man to whom a lowly stagehand was just as important as a powerful statesman. Fortune and world fame were his, yet he always kept a sharp-heeled cowboy boots firmly on the ground. The motion pictures, radio, the printed word, and the stage were used by him as a medium of conveying his thoughts to others, and made his name a household word of tremendous influence. A tireless traveler, he found his material in many lands, but never did he forget his beginning on a cattle ranch in the old Indian Territory. He was at once a cowboy, rodeo rider, comedian, philosopher, humorist, and philanthropist, and his career seems almost fabulous. He might have been half a dozen men, so many were his talents. Through all the plaudits that came his way, he remained humble, always creating the impression that the applause was not meant for him. That was no pose with Will Rogers. Rogers' humility. His humility was the sincerest thing about him. After years on the stage, before the motion picture camera, and behind the microphone, he doubted his ability as an actor. In the picture Steamboat Round the Bend, released about the time of his death, Rogers went to Ben Berman and said, "Ben, you've got a grand yarn here, and I like my part, but I'm afraid that I'm not going to be able to play it the way that it ought to be done." The statement probably never was made before in Hollywood, the world's capital of egocentrics. He frequently claimed he was no actor. He didn't have to be. The character of Will Rogers was what the millions wanted to see, and they gave their hearty approval. Rogers often expressed similar views about his studiously unlettered writings and jokes. He was far from unlettered and actually was a keen student of the complexities of international politics and economics. "Most people think of me as a gag man, Will once said. "You have to be funny to keep them listening and reading. I'm just an ignorant feller without any education, so to speak, but I try to know what I'm talking about. I joke to the public, but I do a lot of studying because although I hand out a lot of foolishness, I don't want to hand out stuff that might be misleading." Knew his audience. "I read editorials a lot, and while I'm reading them, the thought comes to me that I can get this bit of news into the minds of the audience, only in a different way. When I go to a national convention, I have to know what they're talking about to know what's funny. If I was just a clown, Bora and Reed and Mellon and all those fellows wouldn't take the trouble to explain what they're driving at to me. I never worked harder in my life than at the London Disarmament Conference. I ain't for anything. I look at all of them and laugh at them because I don't advocate. I haven't hardly any politics. Of course, I do belong to the Democratic Party, but even the best of us has got to get a little cussedness come out now and then. It's a terribly hard job. The guys that tell you they can be funny at any time without any effort are guys that ain't funny to anybody but themselves. I depend on the newspapers for most of my inspirations. Some days there is material for several good lines. Then there may be a week when there isn't a little thing worth mentioning. But once a month I turn out a gag that I get a big kick out of myself. There's a pretty good average. I try to outguess the people out in front. If I see a news event, something like the Armament Conference, I try to figure out what some particular part of it is going to develop into. I never had the slightest idea but what the Japanese would come out of that conference with more than they took into it. When I made remarks like that, my audience didn't get it at first. Rogers' ideas on recreation were equally simple. He was of the theater, yet he seldom went to a performance. Neither did he care for fishing or hunting. Recreations, riding and roping. My recreations, he once said, are mostly riding and roping. I'd rather work out with the ranch boys. Once I went from California to Texas to help at an annual calf branding. Wrestling a big calf in the hot sun is some exercise. I remember one of the boys said, "You sure have doggone queer ideas of a vacation." Out in Hollywood, I am regarded as an eccentric. And yet when that eccentric died, the legislative machinery of the nation at Washington was stopped to pay him honor. Millions of words were printed about him all over the world. His words were recalled, and it is doubtful if any man without rank or title was ever accorded the homage that was given him. Senate Tribute. In the stately Senate chamber of the Capitol, Senator Joseph Robinson of Arkansas voiced the sentiment of the nation when the Senate convened the day after Rogers' death. Probably the most widely known citizen of the United States, and certainly the best beloved, met his death some hours ago in a lonely and faraway place, he said. We pause for a moment in the midst of our duties to pay brief tribute to his memory and that of his gallant companion. I do not think of Will Rogers as dead. I shall remember him always as a sensible, courageous, and loyal friend possessed of unusual and notable talent. He made fun for all mankind. In nothing he ever said was there an intentional sting. He was kind, generous, and patriotic. His companion was a courageous representative of a gallant group who, on the wings of adventure, sought remote places and conquered long distances. All the nation mourns these great citizens, and they were both representatives of the highest type of manhood. Peace to them. John McCormick. John McCormick, the famous singer who once appeared with Rogers in the Follies for one performance for the benefit of the Mississippi River flood sufferers, sent the following expression of sorrow to the New York Times. Overwhelmed with grief, I send to you, sir, and through you, to his dear ones, my most heartfelt sympathy in the tragic death of my dear friend Will Rogers. A smile has disappeared from the lips of America, and her eyes are now suffused with tears. He was a man. Take him for all in all. I shall not look upon his like again. Tributes were paid to Rogers in all parts of the world, and the great and the near great, many of whom had been targets for his darts of humor, saw only a great tragedy in his passing. There were some who professed to see Rogers during his life everything that he actually was not. It was only a small group of so-called intellectuals who found him irritating. But there was nothing they could do about it, for he turned around and everything he did was successful. When he wrote for the magazines, every first-class periodical in the country wanted his work. In the movies, his salary was reported ranged between $300,000 and $500,000 a year. He tried his hand at polo, and after learning the rudiments of the game, was able to play with the best in the world. On the radio, he received the highest pay on record for a single broadcast. Devoted to his family. Will Rogers was essentially a family man. His home, his wife, and children were the greatest things in his life, but he was no autocrat there. With the children, he played as if he were one of them, and whenever it was necessary to reprimand one of the youngsters, he always found some excuse to leave the room at once and leave the disciplining to Mrs. Rogers. The story is told of an old cowhand who worked on Will's ranch, a talkative, good-natured fellow named Pete, who had been hired to shoe horses and mules. Pete, it seems, had a pension adequate for his needs, and it was suggested that he be laid off. The matter was called to Rogers' attention several times, but nothing happened. "It's this way," said Rogers when pressed for an explanation. "Jimmy, the youngest of the Rogers children, likes to sit and talk to that old man, and when I find out what Pete does to earn his money around here, I'll fire him." Pete left eventually, but not because he was fired. Another incident that revealed the character of the man was the time one of his sisters had died in Oklahoma while he was playing in the Follies. By hard, weary riding, that was in the days before air travel, he reached the town in time for the funeral. As he entered the home, he saw that the room was banked with flowers sent by the men and women in the show. "They can't tell me about New York and show people," Rogers said on his return. "It's the grandest city, and they're the grandest people in the whole world." Will and Dorothy Stone. On another occasion, Dorothy Stone, the daughter of his best friend, was visiting the Rogers Ranch. Florence Ziegfeld wanted to star her in Showgirl, and he called Fred Stone to arrange an appointment. Stone told him his daughter was at Rogers' home. Ziegfeld asked Stone to call her and was told that Rogers would not allow a telephone on the ranch. Stone drove out there, and it was arranged that Dorothy was to start east. In order that no time might be wasted, a manuscript of the play was sent to her by airplane. The plane, however, was 3 hours late, and Ms. Stone had started before it arrived. Rogers seized the script, boarded an eastbound airplane, and flew after Miss Stone's train. He caught up with her at the first important railway stop and placed the script in her hands. It was all just a little fun for Rogers. Still another phase of his wonderful character was shown after the turn of the century of 1934, when the United States took over the flying of airmail. Rogers arrived in New York prepared to broadcast some humorous remarks on the airmail situation. A few minutes before he went on the air, word was received that the commercial plane in which he had flown east had crashed, killing the two pilots and the hostess. He was stunned by the news. He requested that the audience, which was to sit in the studio during his broadcast, be dismissed, and that he be given a small speaker's studio. He then went on the air and extolled the flyers. Tears were streaming down his cheeks when he finished. Never did a mean thing. Will Rogers did an unkind, never did an unkind thing. If he did, there is no record of it anywhere, nor would he hit the fellow that was down. "You folks know I never mean anything by the cracks I make up here on politics," he once said on stage. "I generally hit the fellow that is on top, because it isn't fair to hit a fellow that is down. If a big man laughs at jokes on him, he's all right." Rogers made a major emphasis on politics, and he was able to present his observations in quick, sure, and simple phrases. It was the sort of talk the average American might make if he had Will's great gift of humor. It was that quality that endeared him to the masses. Many looked upon him as the ideal American statesman, and he was seriously suggested for every office from president down. "There's already too many comedians in Washington," he laughed. "Competition would be too keen for me." Rogers never forgot he was a plainsman and that he spoke the language of the common people. He was indifferent to rank and title. A man had to stand on his ability so far as Will was concerned. Only Will Rogers would have dared, as the principal speaker at a banker's convention, to begin, "You're as fine a group of men as ever foreclosed on a widow. I'm glad to be with you, Shylocks." But this barbed shaft coming from Rogers was greeted with hearty laughter. They knew there was no venom in his heart. Truth about advertising. Again at a dinner before advertising men, he delivered what he described as a message of truth about advertising. An advertising club, he told the men, was the mother lodge of liars, and pleaded with them to let a little truth creep into their copy. Will himself once wrote pithy sayings for advertising copy and assured his listeners he knew what he was talking about. "You have members who write real estate advertising," he said. "That's the postgraduate course in lying." That Rogers was absolutely without any bluff or front was shown when he was invited to play polo with the Prince of Wales during his visit to this country in 1924. The game was played at an exclusive piping rock club on Long Island. The prince wore white polo breeches, a tan sweater, and the usual Indian pith helmet. Rogers appeared in ordinary riding clothes with his customary leather jacket. That he was not attired in correct polo clothing made no difference to Rogers nor to the prince. Whenever there was an exchange of ponies, the two seemed to drift together, and most of the time the prince laughed heartily at Rogers' remarks. Rogers defends the prince. Later, Rogers stoutly defended the prince's ability as a horseman. "He's there, and don't make any mistake about it," Rogers declared. "He rides well, and he rides horses that are hard to manage. I only played 3 chuckers against him. It was one of those cut-in games, and everybody got a chance to play. The prince was well mounted. He knows good horse flesh when he sees it. I was riding a couple dogs. One I could have got off and outrun myself. And while we're talking about riding, don't forget those point-to-point races that fellow rides in England. They aren't like cross-country affairs here, with artificial fences that collapse if a horse touches them. They have stone walls built by some king 1 million years ago for jumps. If your horse hits one of them, you fall." In China, while the United States Marines were on duty there at Shanghai, he won the admiration of the Leathernecks when he greeted them. "Take me to the cabarets with the swinging doors, and you can kick open with your feet. I want to see the places our Marines enjoy themselves." Avoids stuffy affairs. While in China, he was deluged with invitations to attend many functions, and he was kept busy avoiding what he described as stuffy affairs. "I want to spend my time in any place where I can talk with friendly people," he said, "and keep my hat on my head." Rogers did not mind sharing the spotlight on one occasion with Oscar, head waiter at the Waldorf. Oscar was busy directing his corps of waiters as they hurried around serving 1,500 members of the Society of Automotive Engineers. Rogers called Oscar to the speaker's table and presented him to the gathering. The diners rose and applauded. A short time later, when Rogers rose to deliver the principal address of the evening, the diners also rose and applauded. "Sit down," he commanded. "You'll tip over your bottles." Rogers was referring to the fact that prohibition was in effect and that many of the diners who brought liquor to the dinner had the bottles on the floor at their feet. Instead of lambasting the engineers, however, he said he liked engineers because they looked like someone that was minding his own business. Slams the joiners. In a similar occasion, when he was the principal speaker at a drive staged by a merchants association for new members, he slammed all joiners with a yarn about a mythical old fellow in Oklahoma. "Out in Oklahoma, where I live," he said, "there was an old fellow that worked in the oil fields, and they said, 'John, are you going to join the Eagles?' 'Nope,' John answered. 'I am neither an elk nor an eagle nor a Shriner. I'm just going to remain an ordinary drunkard.'" A man of lesser stature than Rogers would probably have been silenced right then, but he had the faculty of delivering such jolts with a roguish grin that made his auditors take it and like it. He then went on to comment on world affairs. Hard luck for Turkey. "Turkey had some hard luck last week," he said. "They had a war all booked, and it was canceled by them at the last minute. You know, you can't get a war with Turkey on a minute's notice. You have to book it way ahead. They looked at their catalogs and tell you they are fighting in 1930, and they have so many wars. They say, like a baseball team, 'We lost 5 and won 3 and are still in the second division. Next year, we'll go out and do better.' England got kind of sore because we did not join in with Turkey on the last war, and we can't go into another war. We are 2 bonuses behind already." One of the speakers here today spoke of the achievements of the association under the heading of Post Office Department. "I see you have improved that in some way. I noticed the other day we had another mail robbery. That's one thing you never heard during the Democratic administration. You had no mail robberies. Robbers never knew when the mail was coming." The United States Senate, however, was always a shining mark for Will, and in one of his radio broadcasts, he held a mock session of that august body to the huge delight of millions of listeners. "The Senate of the United States will now come to order. It is fortunate that we are holding this session in this ballroom of this beautiful hotel to give a lot of you senators a chance to get in here that never would have got in any other way." The New Deal. To show how the New Deal is working, there must be 1,500 people in the hall here. It gives you an idea of the unemployed that are here now. Mr. John Nance Gardner, you just stay sitting right where you are in the front row. You'll have nothing to do with the running of this meeting. I am running this outfit here. I don't want you to go to sleep as usual either, because this is one speech and you haven't heard 100 times. You haven't heard worse speeches, but you've never heard this one. After this meeting is over, I have some good news for you, and you can go right back to your regular business. There's going to be a poker game as soon as this is over. Order in the court. I have just got a bill from the White House. We will have the usual procedure with it. We won't read it. Nobody knows what it is, and we'll vote for it in the usual way. All in favor say aye, and those opposed say no. The ayes have it. No, wait a minute. We have just a small gathering of Republican senators here. I'll fix a place over there for them in the pantry. Maybe a little later there'll be a few bankers that'll I'll have to put in with the Republicans, but you can watch them yourselves. You boys will sit there and be quiet. I am sure that if you'll behave yourselves, the management won't make any holler about you being here. Wait a minute. I've just received another bill from the White House. There's something the matter. They're coming awful slow today. We'll vote on this in the usual way. It won't be read. I don't know what it is. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say no. The bill is passed. At disarmament conference. That was Will Rogers. Presidents, senators, and others in high office, none escaped his witticisms. Even King George once came in for some of his raillery. He prefaced his remarks with telling how he attended the disarmament conference in 1930 and heard King George make a speech. "Some people go to baseball games, some go to other things," he said. "I go for my laughs and things just to disarmament conferences. When the king made his speech, here is something I will never forget. He stood in front of a chair, and we all stood up during his speech. Then he walked out, and we stood still. Then 4 men came in and carried out his chair. We didn't know what it was. Well, it was the crown chair. What happened was, he saw the American delegation sitting there. When he got outside, you know, he happened to think of this chair and think of this delegation and of the way Americans are always curio hunting. And he says, 'Boys, go back and get that chair, will you? And bring it here.' I'll never forget that." President shocked by tragedy. Will Rogers, ambassador of goodwill, was the only one who might have dared to be so flippant without arousing the criticism of King George's nation. But he was loved everywhere for that gentle humor that carried with it a breath of the honest soil from which he had sprung. The philosopher from the prairie lands left millions of friends behind. What the passing of Will Rogers meant to the world was best exemplified by the expressions of profound sorrow that the great men he had known said of him. "I was shocked," said President Roosevelt, "to hear of the tragedy which has taken Will Rogers and Wiley Post from us. Will was an old friend of mine, a humorist and a philosopher beloved by all. I had the pleasure of greeting Mr. Post on his return from his round-the-world flight, and both were outstanding Americans and will be greatly missed." Former President Hoover said, "The news of the death in an airplane crash of Will Rogers and Wiley Post has come as a terrible shock to me. I have long known both of these fine Americans and have long been appreciative of their accomplishments. In origin and accomplishment, they were typically American, with their careers appealing to everyone appreciative of the pioneer spirit. They were great souls, and I feel a sense of deep personal loss in their passing." Governor Lehman of New York said, "I am deeply shocked and grieved to hear the terrible news. Will Rogers and Wiley Post were outstanding figures in American life. I greatly admired both of them. Probably no men in America had more friends and admirers than they. The whole country will mourn their tragic death." Governor Marland of Oklahoma, "The state will want to give them a memorial, but the state can't add anything to the honors already heaped upon them by the sovereigns and people of the world." Most popular man of his time, Eddie Cantor, said, "Will Rogers was probably the most beloved man of our time. He was one man in the entertainment world who more than balanced by his exemplary life any of the scandals involving people of the theater. He was the most charitable, most tolerant man I have ever known. There wasn't an atom of envy in his system. Billy Burke. He was one of the kindest men and best friends in the world. I have known him for many years from the day he was just starting out in the Follies. When my husband passed away, Mr. Rogers was like a brother to me. Samuel Goldwyn. I have lost a great friend. The stage and screen have lost a great artist. America has lost her greatest humorist since Mark Twain. I am too deeply affected to say more. Will H. Hayes. It does not take time to realize our loss. The intensity of this loss is as instantly grasped as the effect of the crash itself. He stood for everything that was right, never for anything that was wrong. Mary Pickford. It is not the length of time we remain in this present human sphere that is important. It is what we do with that time. Will Rogers and Wiley Post gave gloriously to every moment, enriching our lives with the treasures of their accomplishments. A symbol of America. Major General John O'Ryan. Will Rogers dead. That is tough news for us all. He was a symbol of America and Americans, yes, and of our institutions and the opportunities they hold for the ordinary young man of the country. If he will only combine with his abilities the qualities of frankness and tolerance and real devotion to his country. Sidney Kent, president of Fox Film Corporation. All of Will Rogers' friends and co-workers in the Fox Film Corporation are inexpressibly shocked by this terrible thing. As big as this loss is to the Fox Company, however, we must stand aside in recognition of the greater bereavement which has been visited upon his wife and family, and indeed upon all America. Will Rogers brought happiness and the cleansing influence of his good humor to millions, and no eulogy from us could express the loss his death means to them. Gene Buck, president of the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. I can hardly believe that Will Rogers' voice is stilled forever. I do not believe we will see his like again. Irvin Cobb. He was a friend to all the world. Men like him, I'm sure, don't come along oftener than once in a century. Conrad Nagel, the movie star, chose a selection from Shakespeare as the most fitting epitaph for his friend. It reads, "His life was gentle, and the elements so mixed in him that nature might stand up and say to all the world, this was a man."